when we talked about the very first class, when we talked about the relationship between Cartesian, the first two classes, when we talked about the relationship between Cartesian and Kantian philosophy of perception, we said in Cartesian philosophy of perception, the skeptic says, well, it appears to me as if I'm in front of a fireplace. It appears to me as if I'm in a classroom. But how could I know I'm in a classroom? I might be dreaming. And we saw that in the case of the Kantian variety of the skepticism, it became a question, how could I so much as even dream that I'm in front of a fireplace? How could things even seem that way? So there's something that's taken for granted in the Cartesian variant. In this way, that experience can have a content. It can be the kind of thing that's true or false. That things can appear a certain way. So there's a relationship in the Cartesian case between what's going on between me and how things are in the world. In me, I'm having a mental content of the sort in front of a classroom. Jim in front of a classroom. In the world, there's something going on. Maybe Jim in front of a classroom. And there's supposed to be a relationship in which the one correctly mirrors or represents or whatever the other. And then what happens in the Kantian case is the problem becomes, how can an experience even do that? And that is generally the character of the relationship between Cartesian varieties and Kantian varieties. In Cartesian skepticism, there is a kind of relation between something on this side of the Cartesian gap, something mental, a perceptual experience, an inner state, being in pain, a meaning, go this way, and something physical, how the world is, how his body is acting, the shape of the sun. And the character of that relation, that there can be such relations, a relation in which my experience appears a certain way, in which someone's behavior appears to be pain behavior, but is he mimicking pain behavior, or is he in pain? But that it can be expressive of pain, that it means something, go this way or go that way. Those relations, the possibility of those relations between things on this side of the gap and that side of the gap, are taken for granted. The Cartesian question is always, which one's the right one? How do I tell the right one from the wrong one? How do I know that this is a case in which there really is people in the classroom rather than dreaming? How do I know this is a case of really being in pain instead of pretending and so on? Whereas in each case, in the Kantian case, what happens is that we lose our grip as we think through the Cartesian problematic on how, if the Cartesian has set things up correctly, even before we try to answer him, how there could so much as be such relations. And in the case of the philosophy of language there we're investigating today, I suggest borrowing a word from Anscombe's translation of Wittgenstein. I propose the word accord. You could use a different word, but I think this is a nice word. Accord. So, there's a sign. Points this way. There's something you could do. Say, walk this way. What to say? That's the correct interpretation. What makes that interpretation correct? Instead of, say, walking that way. We want to say, this behavior accords with the meaning of the sign. That doesn't. I say, slightly more complicated example, add two. That's what I say. This is, you know, something I write or a noise I make. He does something. If he goes 7, 11, asterisk, question mark, dollar sign, I will say, thank you very much. How many years of mathematics did you have? This doesn't quite accord. This is not in accord with my instruction. So the idea, there's a performance, and some performances are correct and incorrect. An understanding of a sign, if it has a meaning, should sort performances into those that are correct in the light of it and those that are not. To understand the word red, you have to know how to call red things red. and not read things right. There's some kind of accord between a correct use of the sign and the instances in which it's used.
Yes? It's a joke. If you use the caps on your tastature on the computer and you press the numbers, you could have those combinations.
Sure, but that would but then you, my instruction was not add two, modula blah blah blah. It was just add two. But sure, there's all kinds of ways you could get that. Now, the Cartesian wants to know, how do I know which behavior is in accord with the sign? How do I know if the sign means this or that? If we take it through to the Kantian variety of skepticism, what I was calling Kantian variety of skepticism, philosophy of language, what happens is that this relation itself comes to be mysterious. What is accord? How could something be in accord? What is it that we take ourselves to be demanding of the performance, such that we say it's in accord? So, Kato's gone all the way to 1,000. I said add two, he's gone all the way to 1,000. Looks pretty good to me so far. Then he goes to 1,004. Now I wanted to say, Kato, add two! Now, there's one possible case, of course, in which Kato goes, oh, sorry, I made a mistake. Change this. But if what he says is, this is how it goes on, I went on in the same way, then, quotation four, how can a rule show me what I have to do at this point? Whatever I do is in some interpretation in accord with the rule. If any number of finite instances is in accord with an infinite number of different interpretations of this, then what does accord mean? What does it mean to say, this accords with the rule? Well, if that just stands there like a signpost, this is just some physical stuff and that's some physical stuff. Is this in accord with that? You know, we need some further, you know, conceptual content here. If I say, I want something that weighs roughly the same amount. You know, if we have some further rule, then you can say whether that's in accord. But two physical things, it's not clear what them, for it is for them just to be in accord with each other. You can have regularities, but it's not yet clear how you can have normative accord unless you have some demand for things to be this way rather than that way. So, well, here's a noise. Here's some noises, or marks and marks. So it looks like, no, we need an understanding of this. You know, we feel like saying, the understanding in which these words, add to, mean add to. That understanding. But if any performance is consistent with many possible interpretations of that, if we, the sign itself is not, it's only the sign plus the interpretation. And there are multiple interpretations. And we can't tell from the performance itself which of those interpretations you're acting on, then it looks like things are worse than what this interlocutor says. The interlocutor says, whatever I do is on some interpretation in accord with the rule. Interlocutor's trying to put this in Cartesian way. I might always still be wrong, the Cartesian says, about using the dreaming case. Here too, whatever I do, I might be wrong. It might be a different rule that's right. But Wittgenstein says here, now if you have that problem, if you have the Cartesian problem to the max, then that's not really what we should say. Your problem's worse than that. Wittgenstein's not saying, to be clear about this again, he's drawing this conclusion about rules. He's saying, if you draw the conclusion the interlocutor draws, then you should draw an even deeper conclusion. You have the first problem, then you have this problem. That's not what we ought to say, but rather, any interpretation still hangs in the air along with what it interprets and cannot give it any support. Interpretation by themselves do not determine meaning. This is really just thinking out the point about drawing the arrows in the ground we had at the beginning. If anything I can say at this point involves producing further noises that are only correctly understood in the light of an interpretation, then we've lost our grip on the idea that interpretations determine meaning. Maybe at some point, if I just bully him enough, you know, I can get him to do what I want. But that's true of most animals too, you know. You know, if you have a cow and you say, please go there, cow doesn't understand you. But you kick it in your head and you say, please go there, go there, please go there, go there. Eventually it goes there. Do we want to say, and now the cow understands? You know, so the situation isn't one in which I just make noises. And then eventually Kanta says, okay. But he's sort of trembling. He's not sure what he's doing, but he's sort of trying to make me happy at each point. But what I want to know is, did he understand the rule? In virtue of what do I say that? Well, I say he's got the correct interpretation. But that interpretation requires what? Did he interpret anything we explain the interpretation in front of correctly? That requires what? The correct interpretation. You can see how tempting it is now to want something that somehow interprets itself. As Wittgenstein puts in the Blue Book, we want to say something like, well, grasp the meaning itself is the last interpretation. When we grasp the meaning. But this is a version of a magical solution that comes up all the time in Cartesianism. It's a little bit like saying, you know, the way experiences represent something is their mental substance. That's what mental substance does as opposed to physical substance. That's not very satisfying at this point, once you've got this problem. So then, can whatever I do be brought into accord with the rule? The interlocutor asks, can whatever I do be brought into accord with the rule? He comes back. Let me ask this. What has the expression of a rule, say a signpost, got to do with my actions? What sort of connection is there here? What do we want to mean by accord? What kind of correctness or incorrectness can there be? He's pressing this question. I cut it off here because if we go on, it won't fit Kripke. But we can see how we have a version of Kripke's problem. And then Kripke's favorite passage is the beginning of section 201, which begins the first paragraph of this. So we have an apparent paradox. We think through the problem of what's called rule following in this way. We seem to arrive at a paradoxical conclusion. No course of action could be determined by a rule, because every course of action can be made out to accord with the rule. Actually, however Kato goes on here, I can write a function such that this is correct in the light of that function. But if anything accords with the rule, then nothing does. What is it to say? As I said, it looks like an understanding requires the idea that the rule itself, sorts performances into correct ones and incorrect ones in light of an understanding. We can't draw a distinction between correct and incorrect. It's not clear what correct or incorrect means. This is a point. So it'd be neither accord nor conflict here. That's a version of the Kantian problem in philosophy language. It looks like we're losing our grip on what accord could so much as be in this area of philosophy. He puts the point. The next two paragraphs are ones Kripke skips, I think, barely mentions them, but I don't think he's anything to say about them. What Wittgenstein's doing here, I think, the next two paragraphs, I'll just say this in passing, it doesn't really matter for today's class, is he's suggesting the problem is with the way we set up the problem. We have to go back to the very beginning when we said a rule just stands there like a signpost. Understanding requires an interpretation. When he says the way of grasping a rule, there's a way of grasping a rule which is not an interpretation. He's challenging the assumption which started this whole dialectic. That's not what Kripke does. Kripke assumes Kripke doesn't see that as an assumption. He sees that as an inevitable step. Quotation 6, I think, does nicely kind of bring out the problem we had at the end of the first paragraph. Quotation 5, where we concluded there would be neither accord nor conflict here. To think one is obeying a rule is not to obey a rule. Hence, it's not possible to obey a rule privately. Otherwise, thinking one was obeying a rule would be the same thing as obeying it. It's not enough to be able to say, look, I think I know what I mean when I say add to. And when I say add to, it means to do this. That's good enough for me. I don't know how I can say whether it's correct or incorrect in some further way. But if I can't distinguish between my merely thinking it's correct and it's being correct, then there isn't anything which is thinking it's correct. To entertain the content that this is correct in light of the rule means this has to mean something. I can't have the mere appearance of this without there being at least a possible case of the reality of it. This is this point that he's saying to in 202 about rules generalizes, I think, if you think it through, for each of the versions of Cartesian skepticism that we've thought about. If nothing counts as my perceiving how things are, if what I perceive is always consistent with things being differently, how things are just happens blankly beyond what I perceive, then what does it mean for my perception to represent how things are? My perception is just something that presents itself to me a certain way. All perceptions are just things seeming to me a certain way. But if there isn't anything that is things presenting themselves as being a certain way, then what does it mean to say things seem to present themselves as being a certain way? So this is the Wittgenstein which Kripke is working off of. One thing Kripke wants to say off of this is that the so-called private language argument, which is very famous, which happens later in the investigations in sections 243 and following, is really just an application of this. That it doesn't have something to do with sensations about the inner life. How do I know this is the same sensation again? If there's a problem about how it is I could ever call anything the same again, a fortiori, it'll probably be a problem for sensations. So that, you know, the real private language problem comes up here. And I actually think a lot of problems with Kripke, but I actually think he's right about something there. That lots of people read the private language sections as if there's some special fact about sensation that creates the whole problem. But I think it's an application of a point that's already come earlier. That doesn't mean there isn't things to get clear about sensation talk. But the initial problem that if we can't make sense of how it is that are just being presented with items and saying something about them could license our going on correctly, then it doesn't matter whether the items are inner or outer. Now, Kripke says, let's look at Kripke now. So this is handout supposed to help with this. In the first quotation, he quotes this first paragraph of section 201 about the paradox. And he says what he's doing in his book and his article is trying to develop this in his own way. He says the paradox is perhaps the central problem of the investigations. I personally think that's a bit overstated. But what I think is right is that many problems that come up in the investigations are instances of this problem. It's not just about rule following, as we already saw with the issue about sensation, and that many problems that initially have a different form, like the one back in 84 and 87, but how do we know which way to follow the sign, if thought through, turn into this problem. So I think he's right that it's important. It's not just one more problem. You know, if you get at the right generality and you see it as a thought through version of a less focused worry, then it's quite important, I think. I don't know if that makes it the central problem, but it's a bigger problem than people have thought. Even someone who disputes the conclusions regarding private language and the conclusions in philosophy, mind, mathematics, and logic that Wittgenstein draws from his problem might well regard the problem itself as an important contribution to philosophy. So the thought here is, no matter what you think about what Wittgenstein says about the problem, his getting the problem so clearly in view is itself an important contribution. Kripke says it may be regarded as a new form of philosophical skepticism. Now, of course, one thing I want to say about that is no. I like Wittgenstein, fine man. I don't think he should get credit for discovering a new form of philosophical skepticism. I think that's evident in my calling it Kantian skepticism. The form of the problem, I think, is one that's already coming up. Seeing it has a variant in philosophy of language, and seeing how, when you put it clearly in its philosophy of language terms, it has the kind of generality that Wittgenstein thinks it does. That might be a discovery. But the discovery of the bare fact that a skeptical pragmatic can have this form, I think that begins with Hume and becomes quite clear in Kant. So I think that's to give Wittgenstein a little too much credit there. So this is partly connected to Kripke thinking, I think mistakenly, that the form in which he's put, the particular, as it were, clothing in which this problem is wrapped, namely the philosophy of language one, is somehow special to the kind of skepticism it is. Now, in fairness to Kripke, Kripke sees it's pretty general. He knows it doesn't just have the philosophy of language. He sees it's going to affect philosophy of logic, philosophy of mathematics. He also says clearly, as we'll see in a moment, that we can put this in terms of meanings, but we could also put it in terms of intentions. What did you intend at this point to do later? And that will quickly, if you think about it, turn into the problematic and philosophy of action we were talking about in last class. So Kripke certainly sees that it has some generality. And Kripke also understands quite clearly, as it comes out in the second quotation, that he too takes a mathematical example. His one's a little different in this. But the point of the mathematical example isn't to make a point about mathematics. If you understand the point at the right depth, the worry is, what is it to go on in the same way? What do we mean when I say, yes, he understood that, and he kept doing it that way. He understood the rule, and it's that way he went on, which is correct. It's the same. What does it mean to say what happened before 1,000 and what happened after 1,000 is the same? Well, one thing is, you can never ask whether two things are the same. It's the point I was making here. Without some further rule specification, without some further concept to be applied, they're both the same color, the same size, the same weight, manufactured in the same print. There's got to be something. In fact, any two things are the same in some respect. And any two things are different in some respect. Assuming they're numerically distinct. So to say we're going in the same, we need to have a specification of a way in which it's the same. And as soon as we have that, we have our problem. We introduce that specification. And what is our grasp or grip on it? What is correctness or incorrectness or accord with it? Correctness in the light of it, or accord with it. So the mathematical examples are just meant to be particularly clear that that there's this multiplicity of possible understandings that are consistent with a single performance. But they're not meant to be making a point that doesn't apply generally. Now, Kripke's example is a bit different. It's a bit complicated. But in order to see other things he says, I think we need to look at his example. He too, his example too is about addition and what it is to understand addition. But he develops it slightly differently. Let me modify his example slightly, or more explicitly in a way he suggests sometimes. I don't mean to say it's just this isn't incorrect. Let's say I'm teaching someone a plus function. I'm teaching them to add. That same word I used when I said add to. But now we're not concerned with the rule just add to, but we're concerned with the even more general rule, add. Might be adding two, might be adding another number. So, we learn a lot of these things. Teaching them how to add. But this is my stipulation, just to make the example a little more vivid and tractable. Let's say all the numbers we've added until now are smaller than or equal to 50-some. So we just, you know, stay, as it were, on this side of 50-some. So we teach them to add 45 plus 42, and so on, but examples like this. Now, then we want to get into a slightly more complicated case where things go wrong. And then we want to ask about all of these cases where we were doing this. Were we adding them? Was that person who gets into trouble later? Now it's not getting into trouble by going to 1004, but by doing something else. But we want to ask, is that person at this point someone of whom we can say, then he was adding, now he's not adding anymore? Or do we have to say, well, he was never adding? He never understood the meaning of plus. I wish I hadn't circled that, actually. The meaning of plus. And if we want to say that, then the question, and there's reason to want to say that, the question is, well, what are we saying of ourselves when we say, until now, when we've undertaken to add? We have been adding. We have been doing what we meant to do when we required of ourselves that we add the numbers. Third quotation, when he's setting out the example, he says, I, like almost all English speakers, use the word, typo, use the word plus and the symbol cross, let's call it plus two, to denote a well-known mathematical function, addition. The function is defined for all pairs of positive integers. Now, I want to come back to these sentences at the beginning of quotation three later. At the end of today, we'll come back to quotation three. Remind me to do that. But for the moment, it seems very straightforward. We appear to understand this. He's setting up his example. Then he says, by means of my external symbolic representation and my internal mental representation, I grasp the rule for addition. This is putting a very Cartesian frame on the problem. In order to stay close to Wittgenstein's text, which is also getting the problem going with, as it were, less baggage, I put it Wittgenstein's way. Wittgenstein's way is just to say, there's a sign, that just stands there like a signpost, and then we need an interpretation. Kripke puts this in terms that are more explicitly drawn from a Cartesian characterization of the gap. Doesn't make the problem any less serious, but I think Kripke's way of putting it does, as it were, force a Cartesian frame on our understanding of the problem. It doesn't, as it were, get at the most basic version of the problem. But so Kripke's way of putting it is to say, look, there's an external representation of the rule, using a sign like this, maybe words like this, and then there's my internal representation of what it means. So now we're very Cartesian. We've got these things located in two Cartesian spaces out here, marks, mental stuff, maybe one up point here, but of course, if we know our Descartes, it's not, you know, it's not crucial things not to locate some bit of space between the ears, you know, exactly 3 inches from each one. But more particularly the mind, you know, which isn't really, you know, mental substance is not extended, Descartes will say. That's not the kind of characteristic. It involves an understanding of meaning, an internal representation. So there's the external representation plus the internal representation. These have to yield the possibility of an accord. The right kind of combination of them, such that I can see the one is in accord with the other, what's going on with the marks is being in accord in the external representation. It's in accord with what's going on in the internal representation. Signifies what we want to call a grasp. He's grasped it. He's got the stuff out there in line with the thing we wanted him to have here. That's a very Cartesian picture of the problem. That's how Kripke's saying it up. One point is crucial, quotation 4, under the Kripke quotations, to my grasp of this rule. This is really just making explicit what came out in the Wittgenstein example. Although I myself have computed only finite many sums in the past, I made this explicit by saying no numbers were used larger than 57. No matter how many times I did this, it was a finite number. There's only so many different ways you can combine numbers to add and add them. If all the numbers themselves are under 57. Might be a lot. Again, Kato can really fill the board. Adding all the different, he can add 1 in 57, he can add 1 in 56, he can add 2 in 57. He can fill the board for a long time. But as big and busy as the board will be, it'll be a finite number of applications of the plus function. Is computed only finite many sums in the past? The rule determines my answer for indefinitely many new sums I have never previously encountered. It looks like what it is to grasp a rule is not to understand. It holds in these cases. That seems to be important as a word difference between the parrot and the child. The parrot can repeat exactly what we've taught it to. The child that's learning language can go on its own and use the word in new ways and new sentences. It doesn't just repeat the ones we said. Even a very simple word like red. If I point to a couple of red things, and all you can say is point to those things and say red, then it's not really clear whether you've understood it means red, as opposed to you're just making these noises when I confront you with these things. I can teach my dog to bark when I put those three things in front of it. Has my dog learned the word red? It looks like we want to say you learned red when you can go on and see further red things. In principle, you know, practically infinite number of red things. And say red each time. So the point doesn't have to do with the complexity of mathematics. It has to do with what it is to understand something. It looks like to be able to understand something is to understand the relationship between the meaning or the rule and its instances such that, in principle, other instances could be produced. That's his point. The finite set that has already been produced can't exhaust the meaning, or we don't have a conception of meaning. But if they don't exhaust the meaning, then what do we mean by saying the next one that hasn't yet been produced is what is meant? Istrik, what does that mean? That's the Kantian question in this context. So I've only computed a finite number, but my rule determines the answer for an indefinite number of new sums. This is the whole point of the notion in learning to add, I grasp a rule. My past intentions regarding addition determine a unique answer for indefinitely many cases. He says indefinitely many, because we don't need the assumption there's an infinite number of red things, or something like that. There isn't some axiom of infinity that's required here. All that we need is, in principle, I could produce another one. And if you've understood the meaning of the word, then with respect to that new case, there should be an answer about whether it's correct or incorrect, and you should be able to say. And if you can't, or if you say something completely different than I do, that raises a version of Kripke's question. Now, to make this vivid, Kripke varies the example from Wittgenstein's example of continuing the series. But I take it that Kripke's example is just trying to bring out the point in a different way. The fundamental features of the example are the same. But one thing that's helpful about looking at two different examples is to notice how they do not have a Cartesian structure anymore. The point now is no longer. For Cartesian skepticism, we saw we had to choose our example carefully. If the bird was too many feet away, and I didn't know anything about Norwegian birds, and my eyesight was bad, and so forth, skepticism didn't follow. But here we don't need to say he goes 2, 4, 7. We can go to 1,000. We can go to 2,000. When he adds 57 to 68 in a moment, we don't need to say he got it wrong by one. The fundamental point here, being directed to the very possibility of a chord, means any mathematical example will illustrate the point just as well as any other. Because the question now is no longer to make us worried about how we can tell, and so to create two scenarios that are sufficiently similar that it's a problem of apparent indistinguishability. The problem is, what the hell would it mean for it to be right at all? Now, Kripke's example is we add 57 to 68. And just to firm up his example, I've introduced a further stipulation that we've never, with Kato, this brings out the connect, by stipulating this, the connection between Wittgenstein's example and Kripke's, I think, becomes completely vivid. Because we can see this, in a sense, as an instance of continuing a series. So again, we had Kato doing plus with all the numbers between 1 and 57. He combined them in many ways. He was starting to run out of things. And then I said, okay, Kato, do this one. There's Kato's answer. And Kato says, I've gone on in the same way as before. And Kripke, I think, purposely has chosen a case that is no longer plausible at all. He's not trying to, like, tug at our Cartesian worries about maybe this could happen. The worry more is, in virtue of what do we rule this out? There is a function, call it quas. Kripke writes it like this, quas rather than plus. And quas means, again, I'm slightly varying the example, just ever so slightly to make the connection clear in the stipulation. So let's say quas means whenever you add numbers between 1 and 57, you get arithmetic sums. Whenever one of those numbers is larger than 57, the function always yields 5 as its output. There are actually a lot of computer algorithms like this. When computer scientists are writing computer algorithms, they write algorithms like this all the time. You get into funny cases, and then when you get into those funny cases, you know, it takes you straight to the help problem. Or it closes down. It does something that keeps the computer from crashing, you know. Or chess machines are like this. When there's a certain kind of like indefinite, the chess computer doesn't yield a definite result. Then the chess, you know, program has the computer do a certain kind of thing, which fits a general algorithm for all of those cases, which is basically the least dangerous move. You know, chess computer, if it doesn't know what to do, it tries to do nothing. So there's a lot of cases where it uses these strategic algorithms, and then there's all the other cases, and all the other cases you do the same thing. So this function means add the numbers between 1 and 57 in this way I taught you. If I ever give you one that's larger than 57, write that. Perfectly fine function, very clear. In some sort of way, you might say, well, that's so weird. Much harder than plus. Is it harder than plus? Say I write two choices. Add those and then quad those. And tell me which is harder to do. I can quad them real fast. Gives you 5. Don't feel like adding them right now, if you'll forgive me. Which is harder? Which is the harder one to grasp? Plus or quas? Hardness too. What we mean by hardness can be interpreted in more than one way. I'm not saying you can't make out another sense of hardness. So, what about when Kanto filled the board for the first few hours with things like this? When Kanto did all of this stuff, was he adding or quadding? Was he doing this function until then, and then he switched to something else? Or was he all along quadding? As long as he stuck to these little numbers, it looks like adding. But maybe he was quadding. Here we have a Cartesian question. How can I tell whether he was adding or quadding? And it has a Cartesian structure, right? They're indistinguishable. It, as it were, serves the same function as the dreaming argument. From within my performance, in some ways it's more literally like the other mind's argument. From the outside, what he does is the same. But maybe there's pain inside or not. On the outside, what he does is the same. He produces this stuff. But in the inside, does the little light bulb of the mind mean to be doing this or that? I can't get at it. I can only get at the performance. The mind is, I can't get at the mind. Which is it? I can't tell. It looks the same whether he's adding or quadding. Same behaviors. It's a Cartesian structure. It's another one of these indistinguishability arguments. With the conclusion, there is no way to know. Or there is no way to tell. That initially looks like the problem. Many people read Kripke as if that were the whole problem. Kripke were just making this Cartesian skeptical point. Much as Kripke is written to encourage you to read it that way, it's not just their fault. The conclusion of quotation 6 is, who is to say this is not the function I previously meant by plus? Is this the function I meant or not? That leaves in place the idea there is something which is meaning plus. There is something which is my performance is being in accord with plus. But how do I tell? It's a Cartesian question, that last question at the end of 6. But as Kripke goes on to say, no matter how I try to answer that, the skeptic will always be able to say, then I might be misinterpreting. Now, this is exactly now the kind of question we had about the sign, or all the other Cartesian philosophy language questions. Another interpretation is possible, as I always put it. I might be misinterpreting. And, oh, it was quadding I was doing. How do I know when I was looking at these things that look so much like adding, that I wasn't, as it were, imposing my interpretation of adding on them, as I did when I imposed my interpretation of traffic law onto the, as it were, facts of the British road and almost got killed? Looks just like what we folks do when we add. There are cultures, purportedly in parts of Africa, where they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 many. And they add 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, everything else is many. This culture's got all the way to 57. And then they just stick with this. This isn't exactly many, it's a little stranger. Now, these examples, Kripke says, apply throughout language, are not confined to mathematical examples. Though it's with mathematical examples, they can be brought out most smoothly. A word like table, he says, is something that has indefinitely many uses. How do I know that someone has understood it? What am I saying? Am I just saying, he did this, and he did this, and he did this, and he did this? That doesn't give us anything that can fill out a notion of understanding. It's got to be that he knows how to go on in the right way. That's what it means to say his table. We need an idea of possible performances which relate to his actual performances as they would on our understanding of the word. There's some notion of modality built into the very idea of meaning. Normativity can't simply be exhausted by a set of facts. But then the same questions can come up about table that can come up here. And indeed, when you teach little children this, you do run into this kind of thing. Cavell has the example in the Cavell reading you did of the little kid who says, kitty, 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 very nicely. And then she goes up to this lovely fur coat and pats it and says, kitty. And you realize, she wasn't doing as well as you thought with all those other kitties. You know, she was going on in the same way. She saw a connection, but it only appeared to be mimicking an understanding of kitty. Now, back to plus and quus. Is this a Cartesian or a Kantian question? In much of the book, much of the article, which is incorporated then into the book, what Kripke does is he alternates between two ways of putting it. He keeps giving examples and saying, there's no way to tell in this case whether he's adding or quadding. That is, there's no fact of the matter about whether it's addition or quaddition he means. That is suggests that the second clause is just a rephrasing of the first clause. But the first clause is stating a Cartesian problem. The second clause is stating a Kantian problem. And there's a lot of this in the Kripke, which then makes it very unclear what the issue is. I think part of the reason for that is his initial setup of the problem, in ways I tried to show you, is extremely Cartesian. And I think it's partly because his sense, like the sense of many philosophers, is for it to be skepticism, it has to have this shape of a Cartesian problem. You know, how can we distinguish? We can't distinguish. We can't tell. Wittgenstein thinks of it as skepticism. We're trying to get to be a skeptical problem. So we set it up that way. But Kripke also understands it well enough that he's seeing that the real problem is this other shape. So he puts it both ways, both to make it feel like skepticism and to bring out the deeper problem. But in the preface, in early part of the book, on page 21, as he'd been thinking about this longer, I think it became quite clear to him that the one variant is just a root to the other. He shouldn't see these as appositions. He should see the first way of putting it as a setup for a problem which, once you think through, takes the second form. So I think if he really rewrote the whole book carefully, as we get later into the book, the Cartesian formulations would drop away. They wouldn't keep cropping up again. But patience sitting and down and writing things has not ever been Kripke's great strength. So let's look at quotation 9. Let's return to our example of plus and quus. We've just summarized the problems in terms of the basis of my present particular response. What tells me that I should say 125 and not 5? Now that looks like a Cartesian problem. What tells me? How can I know? Of course, the problem can be put equivalently in terms of the skeptical query regarding my present intent. This is one of these places where I said he's very good at seeing that there's a philosophy of action varying about this. Right now, I said this. how do I know later that my action is what I intended? Something happened. In the causal order, I did one thing, it brought about the other. Synapses fire. I did something. What does it mean to say, but when I did, fits my intention, my earlier intention? How do I know whether it fit my earlier intention? So formulated, the problem may appear to be epistemological. How can anyone know? This emphasis on know goes with that my emphasis on know here goes with the emphasis on knowledge and know, section 3 of Mind and World. It's the introduction that we looked at last time. How can anyone know which of these I meant? But he goes on. So it looks, you might think it's an epistemological problem if you put it that way. Given, however, that everything in my mental history is compatible both with the conclusion that I meant plus and with the conclusion that I meant quest, there's still a bit of a Cartesian frame here. There's some sort of picture of a physical history on that side of the Cartesian gap and a mental history on this side of the Cartesian gap. There's things I intend, whatever those are. I intend to do this. No, I intend to do that. But he wants to say whatever the layout of these two places are, the physical one and the mental one, it's compatible both with the conclusion that I meant plus and with the conclusion that I meant quas. Given that it's compatible with either of these, it's clear that the skeptical challenge is not really an epistemological one. It purports to show that nothing in my history of past behavior, nothing in my mental history of past behavior, could establish whether I meant plus or quas. No matter what I did, it's not a Cartesian case where I couldn't tell at this distance whether it was a tomato or not. No matter how close I got, no matter how long I looked at it, no matter how long I bounced and sunk my teeth into it, no matter how close, how much of a view I have of the history of my performance, nothing could count. It's whether I meant plus or quas. And then he tries to bring that out in a very Cartesian way with the bit I skipped between the dashes. Not even an omniscient God would know. So say there's this omniscient God who can see he can see everything. He can see the numbers Kato wrote. He can see the ones that Kato erased. He can see all the way into Kato's mind. He can see everything. He can see more than we can. The thought is, no matter how many facts you could see, facts here, facts there, looks like we have a problem where any accumulation of these facts still doesn't take away the problem. That it's not clear what accord consists in. That is, all of this could be consistent with an indefinite number of possible understandings of what is meant. If it's under 57 quests, but we can create another function, schmus, to make you want the numbers a little bigger. I'm not going to take questions because I'm out of time. I'm just going to say two more things. So Kripke goes on. But then it appears to follow that there was no fact about me that constituted my having meant plus rather than quest. How could there be? There was no such thing as my meaning this rather than that in the past. There can be no such thing in the present. What was initially presented, the paradox, we perforce use language, taking present meanings for granted. Go back to quotation 3 of the Kripke. Quotation 3 of the Kripke. I, like almost all English speakers, use the word plus and so on and so forth. Read that. And many other words after that. Here we're assuming our ability to come to shared understandings of words simply in virtue of using them. But if we think ourselves all the way through to the Kantian version of the problematic, we've raised the question about what we're doing even then. And to set up the problem, we must take our ability to understand language for granted. So we initially put it as a Cartesian problem. Not a problem about we can so much as mean something. We're taking our ability to mean things for granted and asking whether it's this or that we mean. Do we mean 1004 or 1002 when we say add two at this point? But once we think it through, it engulfs the very capacities we're exercising in setting up the problem. This is another virtue of Kant, feature of Kantian skepticism, which is at the end of those list of features, that Kantian skepticism calls into question the very capacities it presupposes. That's true every time. It's part of why it's not a doubt. We no longer have a doubt about what we mean. To raise a doubt about what we mean presupposes that I mean something in raising the doubt. Hence, boggle about. Now, how do you want to put the boggle? Any way you put the boggle is itself, as it were, an expression of your helplessness with respect to the problem. The boggle itself isn't something that can be clearly presented. It's a sort of philosophical conclusion you seem to be pushed towards, but you can't completely embrace, because to embrace it requires your capacity to come to a determinate conclusion of a sort that is itself being placed in the question. This is, I think, connected to what Kripke's saying in quotation 11, which I won't read through here, when he's trying to defend Wittgenstein his own way for having read. I don't think this is a very good or full account of why Wittgenstein writes the way he does. But Kripke's saying, look, you know, if you really understand how deep this problem is, there isn't something which results here which is a view about the nature of meaning. To have a view about the nature of meaning means being able to produce sentences like the ones we have in quotation 3, which stand still. To see how deep this problem is to see that the words we use to motivate the problem themselves retrospectively seem to be placed under a certain indictment. So, as he puts it at the end of quotation 10 now, when we initially presented the paradox, we perforce used language, taking present meanings for granted. Now we see that this provisional concession was indeed fictive. There can be no facts as to what I meant by plus or any other word at any time, including when I set it up in quotation 3. The latter must finally be kicked away. That's a reference to Wittgenstein's Tractatus, but to the idea that the very formulation you have in such Kantian problems, I think this is itself, you know, a right to think the Tractatus itself is a Kantian problematic, that whenever you have a Kantian problematic, it has the form of a latter you kick away. That is, you present a certain problem, but once you come to see the depth of the problem at the end, there's a question about how the sentences you used to reach the conclusion you appear to have at the end could even mean what they do. You have a problem of the conclusion seeming to render the sentences you uttered nonsense. But if the sentences were nonsense, then you don't have that conclusion, but it's not clear how you avoid it. Kripke's trying to use the word paradox, taking it from Wittgenstein to bring this out. It's not a problem. It's something that you can't actually get into focus. It's worse than a paradox. This, then, is our skeptical paradox, he says. I will stop there for now. So we will continue with Kripke a bit more beginning next time, and we will bring in Cavell's criticism of Kripke and see how what Cavell's doing relates to Kripke. I will draw a bit on the claim of reason as well, which Kato talked about last Monday, but if you haven't looked at that at all, you might want to.